This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 153. Today we discuss Jonathan Edwards and the image of God in man. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed Theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm very pleased to be back recording and discussing. This is episode number 153, and I'm joined today by my friend Jeffrey C. Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Camden?
I'm doing well, and for the listeners who don't know, Jeff is working on a dissertation on Jonathan Edwards. We're going to be discussing a particular topic under that heading, looking at Jonathan Edwards and his doctrine of the image of God in man. That is our subject today on Christ the Center, but before we get started, we do want to mention a few things, a few books that are available now. We have been mentioning in weeks past the autobiography of Herman Bavinck, which is by Ron Gleason, an excellent book, a very large one at that, but one that you're going to want to look and get a view, at least under the hood, of the man who's written the Dogmatics. So that looks to be good, and we look to have an interview in the future with Ron Gleason on that, as well as a book by Paul Helseth we've been mentioning again in weeks past on Right Reason, looking at Old Princeton. Now, Jeff, what have you been reading? We don't always often talk about old books, but talk about new ones. Has there been anything on the shelf that you've picked up and read recently that you found particularly insightful or helpful?
Oh, my. I was trying to think of something I... but it's escaping me right now.
You know, I've just started reading, along with my wife, Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, which every time I've read it, I just am astounded.
Machen, like Warfield, his crystal clear...
his writing is so fantastic, and I just am always astounded by the applicability of what he has written. He wrote it in the 20s as a series of lectures at Union Theological Seminary, I believe, which is eventually turned into Christianity and Liberalism, the book, which has come to embody much of the conservative Presbyterian movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's still...
The founding of the OPC and the founding of Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia.
70 years after it was published, it's still fresh as if it were written yesterday.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So that's Machen's Christianity and Liberalism. There are many versions of that available. The most recent one has a foreword or a preface by Carl Truman. And so that's one I just thought I'd like to remind people of. It's
a
fantastic
very
volume.
Much so. I was just trying to think what to... As C.S. Lewis said, it's good for every one new book you read. What did he say? Two or three or five or whatever old books we should read so that the fresh breezes of the ages blow through our mind.
Yeah, I think he's right because we sometimes become so isolated or myopic in terms of our view of things whenever we only read current works or contemporary works. We don't see how people have thought through issues in the past, and it's... to our detriment to do such a thing. So read some old books.
Yeah.
And there are many to choose from. Well, speaking of writers of the past, ones that can be influential for our thinking today, we think of the man Jonathan Edwards, who by some, I'm thinking of John Piper, he has called Jonathan Edwards one of the greatest American thinkers of all time.
Yes.
You can dispute that claim, but just the fact that somebody who understands Edwards and somebody who is an intelligent person is making this claim, we have to take it seriously, I believe.
I mean, my view is probably, if I had to compare myself to someone who read Edwards and evaluated him, I'd be perhaps closer to someone like Charles Hodge and the old Princeton faculty who appreciated Edwards but differed from him at points. And that's generally how I look at him. I see him as a brilliant pastor, theologian, and of course for a short time university president.
Mm-hmm.
But not perfect in any way. And there are points where I disagree with him. But that's true of almost every theologian of the past. you'll find something to, with which to disagree.
Even Herman Bovink.
Even Herman Bovink. Even Cornelius Van Til.
Yeah, points of disagreement.
The differences are, the disagreements are relatively small and few.
Smaller with some and larger with others.
Right.
But point taken.
Edwards, as you've already mentioned, I'm working on a dissertation on Edwards, specifically on his theological anthropology, that is his view of man, and the relationship of that to his apologetic practice.
Which has a huge implication. We start to think, somebody might wonder, what does anthropology have to do? Well, first, when we're doing apologetics, we're talking to men.
That's correct.
And women. And second, we must understand that these men and women embody a certain reality.
That's
one,
correct.
They're related to God. They're creations of God, and so have a certain connection to our theology proper.
Correct.
And also, our hamartology, or our doctrine of sin, also has an effect on how we go about defending the faith, because men are fallen in Adam, and they don't think rightly anymore.
And, of course, one of the new books that we've been talking about is Right Reason and Old Princeton.
Yeah, and there are different views on this.
So it's not limited to Edwards.
No.
This issue is something that has been a part of the Christian tradition from the beginning, and, of course, also in the scriptures themselves.
Right.
Paul talks about the fallen reason in Romans 1.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he tells us in Romans 12 not to be squeezed into the world's mold, to use the Phillips paraphrase, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds.
So
this is an ongoing issue, not only for academics, but for the Christian life.
Absolutely.
And for sanctification. And it's helpful for us to delve into how Christians have wrestled with these issues. And that's what I'm doing. The chapter that I'm just wrapping up is on Edwards' understanding of the image of God. And there, in that chapter, I discuss, and of course, eventually I'll tie that in with his apologetic. But I'm dealing with what does Edwards understand the image of God to be?
Mm-hmm.
In the chapter, I compare him to Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, John Calvin, and Francis Turretin.
It's quite a breadth of people.
Well, those would be
the big figures
who would remain be the great Christian. You know, they're selective. Obviously, I don't deal with everybody. There's no way. My chapter is already too long. I'm up to 58 pages.
Oh,
I'm just wrapping it up. Lord willing, the next, maybe even this evening, I'll finish up the rough draft and then go back.
We got to stop early then, and you can go celebrate.
So I can go. That's right. I mean, that'd be great. But what has been said is that Edwards has a notion of the image of God which is similar, if not identical, to Thomas Aquinas' views, or not identical, but close enough to be able to say they share some strong similarities.
Thomas has been influential in both wings of the church. Wings maybe not be the right
term.
Protestants and Roman Catholic, and on many points, but one particular issue in which most Protestants disagree is his nature grace dualism, and also his doctrine of the donum super additum.
Yes,
could you describe that and discuss?
That's
then
one
we can
of the,
get into
one of the issues that is. Okay. Now trying to do this in an understandable way. Okay. Thomas, in his Summa Theologia, discusses the nature of Adam, nature of man, of course, exemplified in our first father, Adam, that Adam is created by God with a, this is my description, this is not the language of Thomas, that man is created, comes right from the hand of God with a ontological defect. Again, that's not his language. That's my language and evaluative terminology. In other words, there is, to use the language of Robert Cardinal Bellarmine, who was a later Roman Catholic cardinal, obviously, in the UK, he said that man is created with a languor or a battle or a conflict between the flesh and the spirit. That's one way to describe the conflict. And this, remember, this is pre-fall. Another way to describe it is that the appetites, the lower aspects of human nature, are always threatening to overwhelm the higher faculties like intellect.
Mm-hmm.
This problem arises because man is created out of material. And therefore, God has to superimpose or supervene on human nature in its natural state, in quotes.
And this comes up with this natural state as this concupiscence or self-love.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a moment. Right. Okay. So he has to superimpose upon this natural man the super added gift.
Donum super added gift.
Now, how concupiscence comes in is for the traditional. Now, this I'm not familiar with contemporary Roman Catholicism, and of course it's as varied as Protestantism. Okay. So what I'm talking about is the traditional Roman Catholic, the medieval notion, Thomas's notion. Concupiscence, which is the inclination toward evil, is, according to Roman Catholicism, part of man's natural condition.
Right.
When I talked about the propensity of the lower nature to overwhelm the higher nature, that's concupiscence.
It's a self-love or selfishness.
And that requires, for Thomas, this superadded gift. And what is the superadded gift? Well, the superadded gift is righteousness, holiness, and knowledge.
And it balances out and counteracts
this propensity of the lower aspects of human nature to overwhelm the higher aspects and keeps everything in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
In the fall, what is lost is the superadded gift, but the natural man remains unharmed.
It's viewed in a simplistic fashion by critics as the donum super additum is like a hat. It's really kind of an accident to somebody, meaning it's not essential. So when it's lost, it's not part of your nature. So it's put on like a hat, and when it's lost, they lose the hat.
Right.
And now they've lost the thing that counteracts the inclination of the lower self, meaning nothing is left to counteract the self-love or the concupiscence.
That's correct.
Because it's been lost at the fall.
Now, what complicates the picture with Edwards is that's the language used by Edwards, but not only by Edwards, but also by Turretin. But it's the language used of post-fall, not pre-fall, Adam. Now, we'll get back to that. Okay. So the donum super additum is the holiness of Adam that is given to Adam by God because of the problem of concupiscence. Okay.
Yes, that's
Thomas's view. Now also realize that for Thomas the donum is given, the donum super additum, and donum simply is the Latin word for gift.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Donor.
The super added gift. Okay.
Right.
And from which we get the word donation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which you can visit reformedforum.org/donate.
There you go. That's right. See the connection?
Help us out.
Okay, let me gather my thoughts here. Thomas also, there's another reason for the donum, and that is that man left to himself will never achieve the visio dei, the beatific vision.
Hmm.
In order for man to be able to achieve the purpose for which he was ultimately created, he must have this superadded gift, okay, and there is more to it than just the control of concupiscence. Okay, mm-hmm. There's also the ability for man to achieve his purpose cannot be achieved if he doesn't have the superadded gift.
Mm-hmm.
Now the irony or the irrational rational dialectic going on in Thomas's formulation here is that, on the one hand, natural man can function just perfectly fine, thank you very much, without the donum. And yet, at the same time, the concupiscence problem arises without the donum.
Mm-hmm.
Both issues are affirmed, that man can function perfectly fine, and yet man has a problem with concupiscence. Now, okay, that's Thomas's perspective. Now, Edwards, now here, let's go back to the big picture. Ever since Augustine, the understanding of the image of God in man has been understood in a Trinitarian fashion. Mm-hmm. That is, man reflects God Trinitarianly. And this is often thought of in terms of the intellect, will, and emotions or affections. And the each of these theologians that I compare Edwards to work that out in slightly different ways. And that, of course, is not the bone of contention that I'm dealing with in the chapter, so I don't spend an awful lot of time on that. But all of them affirm the Trinitarian nature of the image of God reflected in man.
That's interesting.
And historically, Augustine at first held that the image of God in man was reflective of the Son only.
Then you got Meredith Klein later, who thinks of it as the Spirit specifically.
Right, and so you do have in the Christian tradition different views, but Edwards and all of the theologians I look at in this chapter all affirm the Trinitarian nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so does Cornelius Van Til. In Introduction to Systematic Theology, he makes a comparison between the Trinity and the image of God in the intellect, will, and affections. And in that chapter on Van Til, that Van Til writes, he argues that there is a harmony between the Father, Son, and Spirit,
mm-hmm.
there is a created, man is created, Adam prior to the fall, there is a harmony between the intellect, will, and affections.
Yeah.
That harmony is of course, a typical description of Adam prior to the fall. You see it in Augustine, you see it in Thomas, you see it in Calvin, you see it in Turretin, you see it in Edwards. In fact, this is how the fall is described as a loss of that harmony between the various aspects of the human nature.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
The concupiscence. Concupiscence is... Now, and here's the problem for Thomas, right? The concupiscence occurs prior to the fall and requires the donum superadditum to maintain the harmony.
So we have problems with that because
yes.
of the integrity of the created order.
Correct.
God created all things and said
and
all
Protestants,
was good.
Historically, the Reformation specifically said that harmony did exist
mm-hmm.
prior to the fall. But with the fall and the loss of original righteousness, there is now disharmony in human nature.
Exactly.
And of course, that's if all you do were to read Turretin or Calvin or Edwards on disharmony from the fall and look at Thomas, you might think they're describing the same exact thing because they're using similar language. But remember, for Thomas, that the problem of concupiscence arises prior to the fall. For Edwards and for Turretin, for Calvin, arises after
right.
and as a result of the fall.
Man was not created with concupiscence,
that
but rather it's,
because
it's
remember, for Roman Catholicism, historically, concupiscence is the part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
For Protestants, and we believe this is based on God's word, it is concupiscence is a result of the fall and original sin,
mm-hmm.
a sinful nature. Okay, John Gerstner, the late John,
writing on directly this subject, right?
Yes, he is the one who is. Argued that Edwards has a donum superadditum or a donum superadditum-like doctrine. And again, if you read Edwards superficially and if you read Thomas superficially, you can draw that conclusion. Now, I need to be careful. I don't mean to suggest that Gerstner read them superficially. But I don't think, at the end of the day, the similarity of language means similarity of doctrine.
Mm.
And now Edwards has his own problems when he deals with the nature of how the fall occurred. But every theologian that I read in that survey fell into the same problem. If you deal in detail with how a righteous creature could have fallen,
mm-hmm.
you are going to most likely, if you don't stop at where the Bible stops, you're going to end up painting yourself into a corner. And Gerstner recognizes this for Edwards. Edwards paints himself into a corner. How does a good creation fall? Turretin falls into the same trap. Augustine falls into the same trap. So you have you have, okay, let's going back to the Thomas and Edwards thing. Edwards talks about a moral image and a natural image.
Mm-hmm.
He discusses God that way. He talks about the moral nature and the natural nature.
Of God?
Of God.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a perfectly fine way of talking. It's similar to the communicable, incommunicable attributes. And he says man has a natural nature, natural image, and a moral image. And in many ways, that corresponds to the traditional Protestant distinction between the broader and narrower image.
Image, right.
Right.
So we ask the question, and there's some differences with Lutheran theology on this. When we ask the question, what was lost at the fall, the Reformed will bring in this distinction, correct?
Right. And I believe Lutheranism says the whole image is lost.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is Genesis 9 and James
9:6. 9:6 says
James 2, right?
Which is after the fall, says you shall not
still
murder
in the image. Right.
Because man is in the image of God.
Right. And so that creates a problem for the notion of the image being totally lost.
Uh-huh.
And someone like Turretin and Edwards recognize that. And so they can't go down that road.
Yeah.
So they need to make a distinction. Okay, some aspect of the image is retained and some aspect of the image is lost. What Edwards says is that the natural image remains, although it is corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the distinction right there. And he's following Calvin and Turretin. The moral image, what we would call righteousness, holiness, and knowledge, and this comes from Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3, where we see what we are renewed after the image in knowledge, righteousness, and holiness.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So Calvin and the Protestant tradition following him say, okay, in regeneration and sanctification, in other words, the Christian life, if these things are restored, they must have been present in Adam and were lost. Okay. So Edwards, following that tradition, says that the moral image is lost, the natural image is corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, you've got a distinction between Edwards and Thomas. For Thomas and Roman Catholicism in general, the natural image is not corrupted.
And for the Vantillians out there, this plays into what Vantil calls the absolute ethical antithesis.
Yes.
Because those who are still in Adam have that lost moral image.
Right.
But those who are in Christ have been restored.
Now notice one of the things that Edwards and Turretin are arguing is that the fall is ethical, not metaphysical.
Yeah, that's the difference, really.
See, and that's where Thomas tends toward, and at least is read to affirm, and this is with the concupiscence issue, that the fall is metaphysical, mm-hmm. not ethical.
Right.
And Edwards and Calvin and Turretin, I believe, following God's word, will say that no, the fall was a rebellion and therefore is an ethical matter.
Mm-hmm.
As Scott Oliphant likes to say, you know, after the fall, was Adam still Adam? Well, yes, but fallen Adam, no longer, you know, pre-fallen Adam.
Yeah, right.
So right there, you've got a major distinction between Thomas and Edwards. The natural image remains but is tarnished or defaced.
Mm-hmm.
The language of Turretin is certain remains and planks of the unhappy shipwreck. That's the language that Turretin uses, and Edwards would agree that so the image still remains, the natural image still remains. And what is the natural image? That would be things like intellect, will, emotions, the ability to communicate, mm-hmm. with fellow human beings, the ability to relate to God. Those things still remain, but they are fallen. They are tainted. Bellarmine, cited by Turretin, says, quotes the scholastics, which is funny because Bellarmine and Turretin are considered scholastics of a sort, that the supernaturals were lost. The naturals remain untouched.
Mm.
That's Thomas's view, or the Thomistic view. Edwards would not hold to that view. So there's the major difference between Thomas and Edwards on the fall. So the Donum, where Edwards and the Protestants will look like they hold to a Donum Super Additum is because they make the distinction between the moral and natural image, or the broader and narrower image. And this comes out for Edwards in his treatise on original sin. The nemesis for Edwards in that work is a British Presbyterian by the name of Edward Taylor. He's Presbyterian, and if you know anything about your Presbyterian history, you know by this time they're on their way to Unitarianism. Mm-hmm. Edward Taylor argued that Adam was created in a neutral state, that Adam and Eve were created in a neutral state, mm-hmm. that in order for them to have any moral character, they had to develop that either in the direction of goodness or in the direction of evil, so that Adam and Eve were not created upright. Okay, that's very important, and that's why...
But neither were they created corrupt either.
That's correct. They're in a neutral state.
Right.
And the problem, of course, is that that goes against what God's Word teaches. And Edwards will deal at length with that in a sermon that he does on Genesis 3. Mm. And Turretin gives a very thorough exposition of this, why man, Adam, could not be said to be created in a state of nature, or in a natural state, or purus naturalibus, in the Latin, the state of pure nature, but that Adam was created upright.
I see.
Now again, for the Thomist, the upright state is a result of a superadded gift. For Edwards and for Turretin and for Calvin, the original righteousness is part of the original creation of Adam. And therefore, now Turretin goes into a very technical discussion of this, and it's actually worth reading. Edwards doesn't give it the scholastic treatment. Edwards is closer to Calvin in the way he writes. It's mm-hmm. more discursive writing. But Turretin goes into a very helpful discussion of original righteousness, and Edwards affirms that, he does not affirm the existence of concupiscence prior to the fall. He does not talk that way, and so that's why I have to conclude that while there's similarity of language, as I would expect, because they're both Thomas and Edwards are dealing with Adam pre and post fall, that there's going to be some similarity of language.
Oh, yeah.
But there's that big difference.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah.
But it distinguishes Edwards and
now, why Edwards, again, Catholic. Edwards' discussion of post-fall Adam and some of his discussion of how Adam could fall is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he ends up basically saying that only the Son of God could have passed the probation. And then he talks about sufficient grace and efficacious grace. And Gerstner says, well, labeling something doesn't make it an answer. And actually, he could have said the same thing about Turretin. Turretin goes into even more detail, but basically says the same thing, that Adam had the ability to withstand had he desired to.
Uh-huh.
But God withheld efficacious grace, which would have allowed him not only the ability, but the desire or the will. But God was under no obligation to provide efficacious grace, and so he didn't. And that same language is found in Edwards.
Now, okay, let's try to put this rubber onto the road of the apologetic highway. How does concupiscence and the different views between Edwards and Thomas, the classical Catholic view, how do those impact the way we do apologetics?
Well, clearly it relates more to the issue of rationality. It relates to rationality, the nature of, okay, who is it you're dealing with as a Christian? You approach the unbeliever.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a person devoid of rationality? Is it a person who has reason, but that reason is used in the service of sin?
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's a person who has reason, all other things being equal. They're not mentally imbalanced or emotionally imbalanced, but it's a person whose reasoning faculties function but always function for sinful purposes. Mm. So Edwards upholds total depravity. There are other issues that enter into this discussion that are reserved for another chapter, the relationship of the intellect to the will, that are actually part of this discussion, because Calvin, all of the theologians, including Edwards, will argue that prior to the fall, there's a harmony that exists between the various faculties of the human nature, mm-hmm. but the intellect rules. Okay, is the governing faculty,
mm-hmm.
and that the will and the affections in harmony follow. Now, Edwards will later on also, be a little less clear on that, and will argue for parity of the faculties. But none of them reflect what I call a post-Kantian skepticism about the intellect, which is the world in which we live.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, they all grant the fall in the noetic effects. Remember how I described Turretin's, noted Turretin's description of the remains, certain mm-hmm. remains and planks of the unhappy shipwreck. So the intellect is included. In fact, Turretin argues that the fall is essentially unbelief paired with pride, but it's unbelief before it could be pride. Because pride arises as a result of rejecting God's right to be governor.
That's an interesting point.
So it's an interesting discussion. But what it shows in Turretin is that you can, that voluntarist versus intellectualist debate within Christian circles doesn't mean, as it seems to for Gerstner, that the intellect is spared in the fall. But for Gerstner, the intellect is indirectly influenced by the will.
Right.
That's not so for Turretin. And yet those two men are considered intellectualists in this discussion.
Of course, Gerstner is in our contemporary situation, right. though he's passed away now.
Right. In terms of the practical consequences, it has to do with the way you go about defending the faith.
Of course.
The intellectualist, the Thomist, will often use philosophical arguments, the five ways of Thomas. Although mm-hmm. even with, when you read Thomas, you discover the issue isn't quite so black and white. But Thomas is understood to treat apologetics as almost a purely intellectual exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas we, as Vantillians, as Reformed Christians, ought to be sensitive to the fact that the whole person is fallen, intellect, will, and emotions, and therefore our apologetic needs to speak to those, to the whole person.
Mm-hmm. That's a good
point. Not just to offer, yes, it is appropriate to offer intellectual arguments, but it also is appropriate to address the affections and the will.
And I think this is a helpful discussion just to go that demonstrates the relatedness of all of so many different portions of theology to the application of it in defending the faith and apologetics. Many times, apologetics is seen as a disconnected discipline, that it can proceed without all the insights from the other portions of the theological encyclopedia. But here we have a very clear example in which a healthy anthropology is going to have much to say.
Now, Edwards
about how
will
we
use
apologize.
Many of those traditional arguments.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes their limitations, though, and his use of the arguments are never in a vacuum. Sometimes in our day, arguments for the existence of God, say from motion or from contingency,
mm-hmm.
are offered in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
With Edwards, they're not. That's not what happens. He presents arguments in a larger exposition of God's word, usually. So they're subsidiary, or they're illustrative, or they're, I don't want to reduce them, but I mean they're used, but they're not, they're in the used in the context of a clear Christian exposition or defense of the faith. Now, that's not to argue that Edwards is perfect or that Edwards is a Vantillian. He's not. There are similarities because Edwards is Reformed.
Yeah,
but not the you're not going to find, again, we're in a post-Kantian a world. Edwards was in a pre-con. Well, actually, Edwards and Kant were contemporaries, but the influence of Kant was not felt in Edwards' day.
So
it is a different world, and we do whatever lessons we can learn from Edwards are lessons that do need to take into consideration the fact that we don't live in the same day and age.
Oh, clearly. Well, but other than your forthcoming dissertation, what are some books on, by Edwards or some other works related that the listener might be able to go to learn more about the image of God and man?
Well, the actually, there's not a lot directly written on that topic. You do get it in the volume one of Gerstner's Rational Biblical Theology of Jonathan Edwards. And of course, my critiquing him does not mean that I disagree with everything he says. There are many things where I think he got him right.
Yeah.
Especially given the context of the larger context of Edwards' academic studies, which have been even and are even now dominated by unbelieving scholarship. But also, in terms of Edwards' own works, the Religious Affections deal with this issue a fair bit. The Original Sin Treatise, of course, is where Edwards spends most of his time on the nature of Adam, of course, because original sin begins with Adam.
Yeah.
And because of his interaction with Edward Taylor, that's where you'll get a lot of this discussion. Freedom of the Will also discusses these issues briefly. If you want a quicker overview of it, you could turn there. There's some good now in terms of there is the one sermon right now, the volume in the works of the Yale edition of Edwards' works escapes me, but it's the sermon on Genesis 3, where he actually puts all of this the more technical learning into a sermon,
into
an easier format for the average listener to hear and the reader to read. In terms of, and of course, you know, there are so many things on Edwards. We even now have a book that's almost 700 pages. It's just a bibliography of the 4,000 to 5,000 or 6,000 items that have been secondary items that have been written about Edwards.
Yeah, and I'd like to recommend a book not written by Edwards nor directly on the topic of Edwards, but one on the subject of the image of God and man. Was John Cooper's Body, Soul, and Life Everlasting, yep. Biblical Anthropology and the Monism-Dualism Debate, which is a very helpful book. I believe that is a Baker title.
It yeah, there's a Erdman. Second or third might edition be an Erdman's. Of that.
Really fantastic. Check that out. And that's just a
Anthony
place.
Anthony Hokema has one, Created in God's Image.
Yeah.
Birkhauer has a volume in his Studies in Dogmatics on the image of God.
Of course, we mentioned Klein a little bit. Klein's Images of the Spirit.
Images of the Spirit.
A very different take than you might hear in a Bovink or somebody.
Right.
But still useful.
Bovink?
Yeah.
And Burkhoff, Hodge. All of the traditional systematic theologies will have a discussion.
They have to. Yeah, on anthropology.
Of anthropology and the image of God.
But it's helpful. I appreciate your insight, and we wish you the best in the rest of this chapter and the rest of the dissertation. Hopefully you can finish it today or soon. But it's a great example of how we have a unity of the theological disciplines, and not a single discipline is entirely separated from the other.
Right.
So we see how anthropology impacts in a huge way apologetics. But that's Jonathan Edwards on the image of God in man, and look forward to that someday in a dissertation sooner than later from one Jeff Waddington. Thanks for listening. We want to point people to our website at reformedforum.org. And if you're able, if you've enjoyed this program or enjoyed the other programs that we have been able to produce, we would encourage you to visit reformedforum.org and click the Donate Now button at the top of the page. We thank you all for your prayers and your support and your very encouraging comments that we receive regularly. And we'd also ask if you're able and if you feel so led to visit us and contribute financially. Help us to continue to distribute and produce these resources free of charge. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.